temporary room or two from nothing but spell weaves. In the meantime, you can assist the workmen in building a permanent addition to the house. What about Albemarle? Suggested Matthew. Our house there is better guarded than this one, other than the fact that its location is well known, and that's gotten to be less of an advantage these days anyway. Why don't we build a gate between it and here? We could use both together as though they were one house. That was actually an excellent idea. I like it, I said, beaming at him. It was definitely simpler than what I'd been thinking. Recently, I'd started considering the idea of using his interdimensional abilities to create a home within a pocket dimension. If it could be done, it would provide us with a place completely secure and unassailable by any... A shiver ran down my spine as my thoughts came together. Of course. Pieces began to fall into place in my mind. There were still plenty of gaps and things I didn't understand, but I knew where to look now. Most importantly, I knew who was responsible for what had happened at Lancaster, and just as importantly, I know who wasn't.
Mordecai, asked Rose, studying me, you have something to add?
Damn, she was almost as much of a mind reader as Moira. No, I lied. Not yet. Later I would need to talk to Matthew, Linarala, and Gary. The three of them together might be able to shed some light on my suspicions. Facing the room again, I finished. Let's get to work. As everyone started moving, Elaine made as if to follow Matthew and Gary, but Rose called out to her.
Elaine, not today. You need rest and food. Your bark can wait a while.
The young woman looked at me, and I shrugged. She's right. Moira took Elaine by the arm.
You can sleep in my room. I don't think I can sleep, protested Elaine. You will, said Moira firmly, and I'll make certain you have no dreams either.
Then she took Rose's hand as well.
You too, Lady Rose. You need sleep even more than Elaine does.
Rose wasn't having it.
That's ridiculous. I have too many.
Rose, I said, interrupting her. When I had her attention, I leaned over and kissed the top of her head, while at the same time touching her pendant and cutting her off from its protection. Shabal, I whispered, sending her into a magically induced slumber. I caught her as her body slumped. Moira grinned at me.
That was a dirty trick. You should have let me do it. I could have gotten past the pendant without the extra showmanship.
Then she looked pointedly at Elaine. Elaine held up her hands.
I'll come along quietly. No need to force me.
Together, Moira and I levitated Rose and escorted Elaine to Moira's room, where we tucked them in for a long rest. Chapter 20 The next few days passed peacefully, full of work and activity. Irene and Penny both awoke after the first day. My daughter was confused, but otherwise normal. She did indeed suffer a significant amount of nausea, but we all assured her that it would pass within a week. It would just take a while for her brain to adjust to the new input from her mage sight. Penny was more difficult. She didn't talk much at first, which was certainly unusual for her. She rejected every effort I made to discuss what had happened to her, and I sensed an underlying anger within her. Naturally, I felt she must be angry with me, but Elise took me aside and counseled me otherwise.
Losing a limb is like losing a loved one, she said. The survivor goes through a process of grieving, and in the beginning, that often means anger and denial. It isn't you she's angry with. It's the world itself.
I still felt responsible, and that made it hard for me to be objective on the matter. So I did much the same as my wife. I didn't talk about it. Penny was keeping her thoughts to herself to avoid inadvertently hurting me with her inner anger, and I kept my mouth shut to avoid burdening her with my selfish guilt. In short, we weren't a lot of fun to be around. Other than that, things at home were busy, hectic, and at the same time comforting. With Rose, Elise, Carissa, and Graham living with us, there were always people around. It almost felt like a holiday. Irene in particular loved it. Once she began to get over her constant vertigo, she was probably the most outgoing of anyone in my family, and Carissa was her best friend. Rose even got into the domestic spirit of things and attempted to cook a meal. When I got word of this, I tried to discourage it, but Moira and Connell had already told her it was a great idea. Lady Rose Thornbear was many things. Diplomat, politician, strategist, chess player, and a wise counselor. But I knew from experiences during our younger days that she was no cook. Raised from birth as a noble woman, she had never been expected to perform such mundane tasks. She could sew, tat lace, and innumerable other things, but cooking was not in her repertoire. Brewing the occasional cup of tea when her maid had a day off was about the extent of her skill. Penny and I had both been raised commoners, and as such, we'd both learned to cook a variety of things from an early age. Penny really enjoyed it, and she often sought to arrange her official duties so that she'd be able to cook a breakfast or dinner for the family now and then. I did the same, though not quite as often, and consequently, all of our children had learned the basics, along with the joys of washing dishes. Seeing them take turns at the task inspired Rose to try her hand at it, and I knew things wouldn't end well. What I didn't factor into my calculation was Moira's ability to read people. She not only encouraged Rose, she offered to assist, and with her advice and help, things didn't turn out too badly. I sniffed at my bowl of potage suspiciously when it was put before me. Everyone else began eating immediately, and I didn't hear any sudden outcries of agony or vomiting. "What's in it?" I asked casually.
"Lamb, barley, carrots, and onions," answered Rose immediately from the other side of the table.
Glancing at Moira, I saw her wink at me. "How bad is it?" I asked her, sending a silent thought to her.
"It's fine, Dad, really,"
came her reply. Then I spotted a grimace on Connell's face. "I knew it. We're going to die, aren't we?" Moira stifled a laugh, then wiped her face.
"The meat was seared a little too much, that's all. Try it." "Is something wrong with your dish, Mordecai?"
asked Rose sweetly. "Oh, no," I said quickly. "I was just lost in thought." I popped a quick spoonful into my mouth. My first impression was that it lacked salt, and someone had gotten a bit heavy-handed with the thyme. The meat was tough, and it had been slightly burned, imparting a faint bitterness to the broth. But it was edible. In fact, compared to her last attempt at cooking over a decade ago, it was practically a miracle. Encouraged, I took a bite of the bread she'd made, and regretted it. It was as dry and tough as hardtack. I dropped one end into the stew and hoped it would soften, but it appeared impermeable to the liquid. I focused on the stew after that. Matthew finished his first and asked for seconds. Delighted, Rose filled his bowl again.
"You ate quickly, Matthew. Do you like it?"
"Not really," he answered with brutal honesty, his tone matter-of-fact. "But I'm just very hungry today. I'll skip breakfast." Rose flinched but kept her composure. Moira's response was quick, though.
"Matt, what is wrong with you?"
"What?" he asked in confusion. "She asked. I'm just being honest. There's nothing wrong with it. It's not bad, it just isn't good either. It's edible, though." The table erupted in loud talk and argument as everyone began offering their compliments or condemning Matthew for his remark. Meanwhile, Rose took her first bite. After a moment, she spoke.
"Well, he's right. It isn't very good, but it's edible."
Then she laughed and patted him on the arm.
"Thank you for being honest, Matthew."
Things quieted down after that, and everyone finished at least one bowl. The bread was a lost cause, however.
"I appreciate everyone letting me try my hand at cooking," said Rose, "but perhaps I should leave it to others from now on."
My first instinct was to agree with her, but after a moment's thought, I said, "Actually, if you enjoyed it, you're welcome to try any time you like. Everyone improves with practice." Irene piped up.
"Like Connell's eggs. They used to be awful, but now they're only moderately bad."
"Hey,"
said Connell, outraged.
"They're pretty good now."
Graham spoke up. "I hope so, because I remember when you brought your first batch down and tried to give it to Cook to add to his slop bucket. Even the pigs wouldn't eat them." Everyone laughed, and as things quieted down, Rose stood up, a faint smile on her face.
"I'll take a bowl to Penny."
"Let me do that," I protested. Rose held up a hand.
"No, I'll do it. If it's too bad, I'll accept responsibility."
I finished the second portal to Albemarle in just under 2 days. Both of them appeared to be normal doors that opened from the back wall of a small room at the end of the central hallway in our mountain cottage. For security, I added an attunement enchantment to the room itself that would deactivate both portals if it failed to detect the aethar of one of the people I'd chosen. I did the same thing at the other end of each of them. The one that opened into my house in the capital was located within the Chamber of Circles. I merely co-opted one of the circle niches and built the portal doorway within. The one in the palace opened into a closet in Ariadne's bedroom. Since the portals were an inherent risk, I kept the number of people attuned to them small. The list included myself, my family, Ariadne, and the Thornbear family. My initial design still had a flaw, though. A hostile enemy could potentially use one of the attuned people to keep the portals open while they or others passed through. Matthew suggested adding a second enchantment to alleviate that problem. After some thought, I agreed with him. This additional protection would shut down the portals if the aethar of anyone other than those attuned entered. Since this would also make it impossible for us to allow anyone else through, I added a password that would bypass the second enchantment's effect. This meant that an enemy would have to have one of the attuned people and know, or at least know about, the password. If someone learned it, for example, by hearing it spoken while being allowed through on one occasion, they would still require the presence of one of the attuned people to use it. I also made certain I could easily change the password in the event that I knew someone outside the family had learned it. Of course, even with that, nothing was perfectly safe. If the enemy knew about the password and already had possession of one of us, they could torture that person to force them to reveal it and then use it and that person's living body to pass through the portal. To minimize that, I made sure only a few of them knew that password even existed. Myself, Penny, Rose, Matthew, and Moira. I told the rest that the portal could only be used for themselves and left the extra protective measure out of my explanation. Was I paranoid? Damn right I was. I had been for years, and despite my best efforts, my enemies had managed to harm me and my family. Just a few months prior, my daughter Irene had been kidnapped from my supposedly secret mountain home. While I'd been involved with that project, Elaine, with Gary's help, had learned to create a privacy ward that would specifically block a wide range of signals that Ansys might potentially use. Since it was a type of barrier rather than a type of invisibility veil, she was also able to teach it to the rest of us, which she did with the exception of Irene. Irene was just beginning to learn to shield herself, so she had a ways to go before she could attempt anything as complicated as warding or creating enchantments. Once we understood the technique, I gave Elaine the task of adding her special privacy ward to the enchantments that protected my home, and when that was done, she moved on to Castle Cameron itself. Gary suggested creating interior barriers as well, so that if any Ansys units managed to enter, they couldn't coordinate with one another. It was a large task, since it meant you would have to create enchantments to protect each room within the castle, but it would effectively limit them to communication distances as small as whatever room they were in. Was it overkill, especially considering we didn't have any known enemy in the castle? Damn right it was. As I said earlier, I'm paranoid, and for good reason. I would have had Connell assisting her, but Matthew had already appropriated his younger brother to help with the antennae that he and Gary were building. Since I was finished with the portal, I decided to check on them and see how they were progressing. I found Connell in Matthew's workshop in the castle yard, but his older brother and Gary were absent. When I entered the building, which had at one time been my father's smithy, I saw that Connell was hard at work. A modest pile of copper nuggets sat by one side, while still more had been loaded into a crucible that was just coming out of a newer furnace that Matthew had built the year before. My father, Royce, hadn't done much in the way of smelting, but Matthew's projects often required considerable volumes of fresh metal and occasionally an alloy. As he brought the crucible out, Connell immediately began siphoning out the liquid metal using his aether. The copper began to cool quickly as it left the crucible, and he stretched and formed it into a wire that was nearly a quarter of an inch thick. As it solidified, he looped it and shaped it into a coil on the ground a few feet away. To be fair, we could have brought copper wire from the foundries in Albemarle, but the cost was high and the supply was small. There wasn't a lot of demand for it, and if we had made an order, it could have taken months for them to fill it. Copper itself was very valuable, so purchasing the raw material would have been exorbitant as well, even if we planned to produce the wire ourselves. Fortunately, precious metals were not a problem for me. Many years before, when my children were still young, I'd nearly been bankrupted after agreeing to pay a vast wergill to the survivors of the Duke of Tremont's estate. Prior to that, I'd been trapped in the body of an undead monster, my actions controlled by an alter ego that was slowly going mad. My alter ego, aptly named Brexus, or Payment in Lycian, had sent a horde of Shigreth to the Tremont estate, with horrifying results. Thousands had been murdered, and the lands were still uninhabited. People thought they were haunted. In any case, the Wehrguild, or Payment for the wrongly murdered, had been massive. Lady Rose had defended me in court, and had found a loophole that would have allowed me to avoid punishment, but I refused to take that route. After my conviction and subsequent flogging, paying the fine had used up nearly all the wealth I'd inherited from both the Cameron estate and from the Alineal family. Before that, I'd been one of the three richest men in Lothian. These days, I was only in the top 10, but that was mainly by choice. As an archmage, I'd used my abilities to manipulate the earth, and it had provided whatever I desired. If I'd wanted, I could have brought forth enough gold to wreck the market. Instead, I'd varied which metals I produced and how much of each I released into the market. Initially, I'd been a bit malicious, releasing quantities designed to ruin a few of my nastier political foes who relied on mining for their fortunes. But after that, I'd moderated myself. Now, I only produce small amounts, and only rarely, except for instances like this, when I had a particular use in mind. Matthew and Gary had told me they would need a substantial amount of copper, so I'd provided it, but from the look of what remained, they might need more soon. "How's it going?" I asked Connell as he finished his current batch of wire. Wiping his brow, he gave me a look that said, "Pity me."
"It's awful," he complained. "I'm just slave labor here."
I grinned at him. "What you've done would have taken dozens of men and many hours to do in the normal fashion.
At least they would have been paid for it," he said with a sigh.
Contrary to popular belief, wizardry is work. It might be much easier, more efficient, and capable of wonders, but using one's power all day long was exhausting. Which is why it's good I have four capable children, I thought. "You are being paid," I told him. "Your work is helping to protect not only you, but your family, and hopefully the entirety of Lothian. Isn't that sufficient reward?"
He muttered. "There are one or two in my family I'm starting to rethink protecting. In fact, I have a particular brother I might be willing to sell to the enemy if they offer me a decent price right now."
Nodding, I sighed and looked off into space. "I know what you mean. I was once offered a vast sum by Nicholas of Gododdin to adopt one of my children. You were just an infant at the time. I often wondered if I should have taken the money." Of all my children, Connell was the most gullible, and while he had learned to mistrust the things his older brother told him, he still treated most of my pronouncements with quick belief.
"Really?"
he asked, astonished. I waved my hand at him. "A lot of noble houses were killed to have a wizard in the family. You would have been very valuable to them."
"I would have been a prince," exclaimed Connell.
"Should I send him a message and tell him you're interested in a late adoption?" He heard the hidden laughter in my voice then, and his eyes narrowed.
"Damn it, Dad, it's bad enough when Matt does it."
I hugged him as I laughed, ignoring the dirt on his clothes. Sorry, I couldn't help myself. In fact, I probably could have sold my children. There were a lot of wealthy families that would have paid for the opportunity to have such power in their grasp, but none of them had ever dared offend me by making such an offer, and I would have refused. Probably. "Where have Matthew and Gary gone off to anyway?" I asked him.
"Malvern," responded Connell. "They're starting to work on the antenna there."
"So old Malvern agreed," I commented. "I hadn't heard that news yet." My youngest son nodded.
"You'll have to take the world road if you want to check in on them, since we don't have a circle there."
"Where will they be?"
"Lord Malvern is letting them put it atop his keep."
"I guess I'll go check on them then. I haven't been to Malvern in a long time." I headed to the transport house and took the circle that would put me on the world road. After that, it was just a short walk to the Malvern portal. Chapter 21 Malvern was a sunny, coastal city. It wasn't as big as Albemarle, of course, but it was significantly larger than Washbrook. There were at least 10,000 or 15,000 people living in the city and surrounding areas. The city itself wasn't walled, and it was a long way from the border with Gododdin, so war had never been a problem for the inhabitants. It was a modestly prosperous port, but the count that governed it kept a strong fleet to protect it. Count Malvern's keep stood on a hill that overlooked the city. To the west, the keep looked over a steep cliff that plummeted straight to the sea, and to the south of it was a small road winding its way into the town proper. The castle wasn't particularly impressive. There was no outer wall or towers, just a tall square keep that rose perhaps 80 feet in height with battlements at the top. A wide flight of stairs led up to a heavy oak door broad enough for two men to enter side by side. From the portal that opened near the city, I flew to the keep. From my height, I could see activity on the roof, and my mage sight confirmed it as soon as I was within range. Gary and Matthew were there, constructing something. Unfortunately, I didn't want to insult the lord of the castle, so I needed to pay him a visit before heading to the room. The count, Stephen Malvern, was a decent fellow, close to my age. I'd met him on several occasions. He'd lost his wife during the first year that the Shigreth had plagued Lothian. In fact, while I'd been dead, Penny told me that he was one of the suitors that Rose had tried to convince her to marry. I didn't hold that against him, though. He'd since remarried, and he'd always been polite when I'd met him. Now, I was glad we had no bad blood between us, since his keep was apparently an ideal spot for the antenna that Gary wanted to build. A servant ushered me in to see the count, and I found myself being escorted up a series of stairs. It turned out my host was already on the roof, watching Matthew and Gary's work. He greeted me as I stepped out into the stiff, salty breeze coming from the shore.
"Lord Cameron, it's good to see you again,"
he said, offering his hand to me. I shook it, replying, "Malvern, you're looking well."
"Call me Stephen," he insisted.
I agreed and returned the offer, and then he began peppering me with questions.
"Can you explain this thing to me, Mordecai? Is it some sort of wizardry?"
Gary and my son were mounting a long wooden support pole, and next to them they had several substantial coils of Connell's heavy copper wire. "There's no magic involved in this, Stephen, not as far as I can tell. As I understand it, the copper wire will enable us to capture signals that our strange enemy uses to communicate. You've been informed of what went on in Dunbar, correct?" Cal Morvan nodded.
"Yes, some sort of mechanical foe, I heard. I'm not sure how this relates, though."
"They use an invisible type of light to communicate," I began. He interrupted me almost immediately.
"If it's invisible, then it isn't light."
I sighed. "Whatever you call it, it's the same sort of thing light is. You just can't see it. The metal will resonate and produce an electrical current when the signal strikes it." Stephen frowned.
"What kind of current?"
"Electrical," I repeated. "You're familiar with lightning. This is the same sort of thing, except..."
"How dangerous will this thing be?"
The rest of our conversation was frustrating, and it was mostly incomprehensible to the Count of Malvern, but he did at least accept my assurance that we weren't endangering his castle. He gave up trying to understand after a while, and left me to talk to Gary and Matthew. Gary smiled at me, his android face almost perfectly imitating the human expression. "I listened to your conversation. It's impressive how quickly you've learned the principles of electromagnetism." Still irritated from my talk with Count Malvern, I ignored the compliment.
"What I'm really curious about is how you plan to locate the enemy with this. I understand how you'll detect the signal, but from what you've said, you won't be able to determine a direction. If that's the case, you can't triangulate."
"Correct," said Gary. "However, we will have multiple receiving antenna, and the signal strength will be different at each location. Using that information..." I interrupted him. "Even if you had accurate signal strength, that would only give you an approximate distance. But you don't have that, because you don't know how strong the signal is at its source."
"Very true," he answered. "But I can compare the signal received at each point and get a ratio that, when combined with the known distance between those points, will give an approximate distance."
"Clever," I thought. "With three approximate distances, he can create circles and trilaterate the source."
"That only works if the signal originates between receivers, though, and you'll need three signals to determine a rough location, assuming it's inside the area of the triangle."
"That's why I would like to create more antennae at other locations, such as Serentia," said Gary. "But I also have a method to determine location, even if the signal comes from a place beyond the outer boundary between receivers. If I measure the difference in time of arrival of the same signal at widely separated locations, I can also get an approximate distance, even if the source is not between them."
I thought about that a while, digesting what he'd said, before finally asking, "What about speed?"
"Pardon?" said Gary.
"To estimate distance from time, you need the speed the signal travels," I clarified.
"Right?"
I was in over my head, but I was determined to understand.
Matthew spoke up.
"That's the easy part. The signal is composed of light, so it travels at the speed of light."
"The what?"
"As far as I knew, light didn't have a speed. It was instantaneous."
Then again, it hadn't been that many years ago that I thought the same thing regarding sound.
Matthew grinned.
"I did some reading back in Karen's world, and Gary's explained a lot more since. We can go over this later, but trust me for now, it does have a set speed. The problem for us mere humans is that it's so great that it seems instantaneous, even over large distances. Luckily for us, Gary can measure time in very tiny increments."
Things got more interesting from there, and I was amazed at the precision and scope of the knowledge people had possessed in Karen's world. After a while, though, it was obvious that I was slowing them down, so I curtailed my questioning and bid them goodbye.
Gary stopped me.
"One moment, Mordecai. I wonder if I can get your help with a small experiment."
"Sure."
A moment later, the android handed me a straight metal rod.
"Today the weather is clear and visibility is almost perfect. Since we are by the ocean, it's the perfect place to do this."
"What do you want me to do exactly?" I asked.
"Take this rod, which I've measured to exactly 2 meters, and fly out over the water. Matthew will stay with me on the beach at the water's edge and communicate with you telepathically. When you're nearly over the horizon, I'll have him ask you to stop and place the bottom of the rod at the point where the wave tops are just touching it. From there, I will have you keep moving away until I can no longer see the top of the rod. Then he handed me the small rectangle that I had first talked to him through. The rectangle was a device from Karen's world that she called a PM. It was an item of technology, just as Gary's body was. In the past, he'd spoken to us from it. "What's this for?" I asked. "And what's a meter?" "A meter is a unit of measurement from my world, one much easier for me to work with. This will help me determine our exact distance to you. I cannot communicate with you through it from that distance, but I can measure the signal it emits to determine distance. Ideally, that would be unnecessary, but I have a hunch I may need the extra information," answered the machine. "What are you trying to figure out?" "The exact curvature of your world," said Gary. I laughed. "I have that information in my library. Mariners and navigators have already done all of this. I can show you the charts tonight." The android was insistent. "Nevertheless, I would like to do this. We can compare the figures from your charts with my results this evening." When I got home a few hours later, I took a bath. I hadn't really gotten dirty, but the sea spray had left me feeling sticky and smelling funny. Penny was feeling stronger, and everyone else was out of the house. A rare, quiet moment. She was moving around the house, which I took as a good sign. I just finished drying off and had donned a long tunic when I heard a yell from the direction of the kitchen. Running, I was there a few seconds later, and I found Penny sitting on the floor by the counter, crying, carrots and turnips scattered around her. Her favorite kitchen knife was embedded in the mantel over the door. "What happened?" I asked worriedly. Her head was down, staring at the floor tiles.
"Go away," she said quietly, a warning in her voice.
Ignoring years of marital experience, I approached her anyway. "Talk to me, Penny." My wife's answer came in a growl.
"Go away. I can't help if you don't talk to me." "Isn't it obvious?" she yelled. "I only have one damned arm. I'm useless. I can't cook. Do you know how many things you can do with only one fucking hand? I can't even peel a godsbydamn turnip."
There were tears of rage and frustration in her eyes. I wanted to get closer, to hold her. But she jerked when I started to move.
"Don't," she warned. "Leave me alone. Can't you see my hand? I'm holding it up to tell you to stay the fuck away."
She was pointing at her missing arm with her right hand.
"It's still there. I can feel it. Do you see it now? I'm waving it at you."
"It's hard. I know," I said soothingly. "It'll take time to adjust."
"Adjust?" she croaked. "I can't dress myself. I can't undress myself. Do you know how humiliating it is to have to ask Moira or Irene to help me when I have to relieve myself? How am I supposed to live like this?"
Without a good answer for that, I simply sat down myself across the room from her. What could I tell her? Was this the right time to suggest I could heal her? "I think there's a way to restore your arm," I said finally. Penny didn't look at me.
"Matthew told me. It sounds better than this, at least."
Her voice was flat, empty.
"Who knows how long it will be before either of you have time to waste on something like that?"
"First, you aren't a waste. You've never been a waste. You're far more important to this family than I am. You're far more important to me. And second, I wasn't talking about a metal arm. I think I can restore your flesh and blood arm." She looked up, and her face shifted through a range of complex emotions. First hope, and then suspicion showed in her eyes.
"What does it cost?"
I shrugged. "Nothing."
"Then why haven't you done it already? Don't play games with me, Mort. I know you better than that."
"I wanted to wait until you were fully recovered." Penny picked up a carrot and tossed it up onto the counter.
"There's no such thing as fully recovered, not while I'm missing an entire arm."
"I meant your health." Wiping her eyes, she replied,
"I know what you meant. And you're still not telling me everything. It's dangerous, isn't it?"
"Everything I do is dangerous," I said. "Everything involving my unique abilities, anyway. I would have to become you, like I did when you were hit with the ballista bolt. We could vanish or wind up a single person, fused together. In the best case, it works, but we never really know who was who to begin with." She exhaled, releasing a dark laugh.
"I can't blame you for not wanting to be me."
Grinning, I replied, "I'd feel worse for you if you wound up stuck as me."
"That sounds grand to me," she said. "Do you have any idea how much I envy you sometimes?" "No. Of course you don't. Remember when we were little? There wasn't much difference between us then. You were just this awkward, skinny kid. No one understood you back then. But I did. I saw your heart, your kindness. I loved you, and I didn't care that you were nobody. I was nobody. Then you became a wizard, and suddenly you were at the center of everything, and I was still nobody. But for some reason you loved me anyway, and lo and behold, it turned out you were the lost heir of the Camerons and the Illenials. Everyone wanted you, but wanted to kill you. You were important. But who was I? I was just the plain girl you refused to let go of. For a while I was your bodyguard, and I had some purpose. At least I was able to stay with you. But I could hear them talking. Did you ever wonder what I might hear with these inhumanly sharp ears you gave me? How many of those fancy lords and nobles might say things without knowing I could hear them? They felt sorry for you, or worse, thought you were a fool for wanting to marry me. But you married me anyway. How could I refuse? You were all I ever wanted. But I still felt ashamed. I should have let you go, pushed you away. But I was too selfish, too stubborn to let anyone else have you. Now I spend my days pretending. Pretending to be something I'm not. Pretending to be important. Pretending to be a leader. And all I really want is to be invisible. I wish you were nobody so we could go back to those days.
She finished with her head resting on her knees, staring at the floor.
Penny. I know,
she interrupted.
I'm wallowing in my own self-pity. Just let it be. I'll be the Countess tomorrow. Right now I just can't do it. I'm tired.
Standing up, I crossed the room and sat down beside her, putting one arm around her shoulders. I want the same thing, I told her. So many times I've wished we could just forget about all of it and run away. There's only one thing in all of this that keeps me going, one consolation that makes it bearable.
If you say it to me, I'll knock you across the kitchen,
she said ruefully. No, I answered. At least, not the you I first fell in love with. You were sweet back then, but it's the woman with me now that makes it worthwhile. The Penny I knew as a kid, she wasn't anybody, but I loved her. But that isn't who you are anymore. You're the girl who refused to give up on me, the one who didn't care if I was a nobleman or not, a wizard or not, the one who didn't listen to all the stuck-up assholes who thought they knew better than I did about what was good for me. Maybe you think you're pretending, but no one else does. You've held this place together when I wasn't there. You've fought for our children when they didn't know what to do themselves. You've saved me from my own bullshit so many times I can't even count them. The only thing that's kept me going is you, watching you refuse to give up. You've always been too damn stubborn to let them beat you down. That's why I love you.
She gave me a strange look. Because I'm stubborn.
There's nothing so precious as the love of a stubborn woman, I said, smiling through my own tears now. Penny didn't say anything, and after a while, she leaned over and kissed me softly. Are you going to knock me across the kitchen now? I asked afterward. She chuckled lightly.
I haven't decided yet.
Then she stood and offered me her hand to help me up. I took it, and after I'd risen, I started to leave the kitchen, pulling her along with me.
Wait,
she told me.
What?
She glanced around, and then I realized the kitchen was still a mess. Oh, yeah, I said glumly. The Count and Countess de Cameron spent the next several minutes picking up vegetables and cleaning the kitchen. Chapter 22. Open it, I commanded. Peter Tucker, my chamberlain and longtime servant, stepped forward with the keys. I could have opened the lock myself, with or without a key, but I'd learned never to use magic in front of regular folks unless it was necessary. For one, it startled them and sometimes left them confused, but even worse than this, it was a constant reminder of the difference between someone like me and them, and also sometimes led people to strange expectations. Why should they do anything if I was present and could do it easier and faster? While Peter shuffled the keys, Sir Graham moved up beside him, putting himself between me and the doorway. Lady Thornbear's apartment had been locked after the bodies were removed so that nothing would be disturbed. With my mage sight, I already knew there was nothing living within, but Graham took his duty seriously, and besides, our new enemy didn't fit the traditional category of living. Before Peter found the key, Graham voiced a quiet word, and the enchanted tattoo on his arm flared to life. Metal scales flickered into existence and fluttered around him briefly, like a cloud of shining silver butterflies, before settling and locking into place. In a few short seconds, he went from being unarmored to being better protected than any man in the entire kingdom. His armor was unique, a product of my son Matthew's special genius. It covered him from head to toe like a metallic reptilian skin, but unlike traditional scale mail, it suffered from no weaknesses. The individual pieces moved freely with him, but when confronted with an exterior force, such as a sword blow or an arrow, they locked in place, becoming more rigid than a solid plate of steel. It formed not only armor for his body, but his head as well, and the parts that covered his face were invisible, allowing him to see. The armor's wonders didn't end there, however. The enchantment also included his sword, which had been reforged from his father's greatsword, Thorn. The sword could take several forms, that of a greatsword, twin arming swords, or a sword and a large heater shield. It could even be commanded to take on its original broken form before it had been remade. With just the tattoo on his forearm, Graham could go from being unarmed and unarmored to thoroughly equipped with a variety of weapons depending on the situation. If Penny had had armor of a similar sort, she wouldn't have lost her arm, but I'd never found the time to bother repeating my son's feat of enchanting. For now, Graham's sword and armor were unique. As the door opened, Graham eased Peter aside and entered the room, surveying it quickly before continuing on to check the rest of the rooms. Personally, I thought his insistence on so much caution was excessive, but Graham was much like his father in this regard, rigid, loyal, and stubborn to a fault. "Clear, my lord," he called to me. "I already knew that," I grumbled internally. As I stepped into the small waiting room, my eyes confirmed what my arcane senses had already reported. Rose's living quarters had been destroyed. The floor was covered in dried blood, and sunlight entered from the direction of her bedroom, where a wide hole had been created in the wall. The doorway from the sitting room to the living room was largely gone. Irene's blast had removed it, along with portions of the wall on either side. The wall between the living room and Rose's bedroom had entirely collapsed, giving a clear view of the round hole in the exterior wall. The man that had been atop Rose was gone. All that had been recovered of his body was part of his right leg, the ankle and foot. The rest of him had been blown out of the room and seemed to have been incinerated in mid-air. Only ash and rubble had been found in the castle yard. I'd already examined the female assassin's remains, but that had left me with more questions than answers. Her name had been Mary, and she'd been the young wife of the tanner in Washbrook. The tanner himself was missing, so the obvious conclusion was that he'd been the male assailant, though we had no way of confirming that. Both Mary and her husband had been well-liked and respected in Washbrook. I hadn't known them well, but I'd seen them at least twice a year at the feasts I held for the villagers of Washbrook, one of my duties as their liege. I'd liked them both. From Rose's account, I'd expected Mary Tanner's body to harbor one of the metal parasites we'd encountered in Dunbar. There'd been no sign of one, nor had there been any tissue damage to her throat or neck. If she had been harboring an Ansys parasite, I could find no sign of it. Had she been acting on her husband's behalf? Was he the only one being directly controlled? I couldn't believe that either. The evidence pointed to both of them having scaled the wall to enter Rose's apartments through the window. Mary Tanner was a healthy woman, but she hadn't had the strength to do such a thing, and neither had her husband. No rope or other climbing tools had been found. Also, Rose's description of their behavior pointed to them having been controlled. Normal humans don't ignore fatal wounds as Mary had. Normal men didn't ignore a solid knee to the groin. Graham started toward the door that led to his own bedroom, but I cautioned him. "Don't. I thought we were going to search everything," he observed. "Give me a few minutes. Don't touch anything," I ordered. "I want to examine it carefully before we start moving or touching anything." To illustrate my point, I closed my eyes. Giving my full attention to my mage sight, my focus roamed through the apartments like a disembodied ghost. Clothes, jewelry, teapot, cups. Mentally, I catalogued each room, searching through every nook and cranny. Everything seemed normal. Everything was mundane, except for one small oddity. There. In the corner of the main room, near the hearth, there was something metallic that I couldn't identify. It was flat and irregularly shaped, conforming to a small niche in the brick that enclosed the hearth. I moved toward it, with Graham following close behind me. Bending my knees, I stared at the space where I'd located it. There was nothing visible, though my mage sight still showed it there. Something invisible. Stretching out one hand, I was surprised when it moved. I jerked my hand back. It had risen slightly, as if it meant to meet my fingers. Still, my eyes had seen nothing. "There's something here," I muttered. Creating a probe of pure force, I extended it, attempting to touch whatever it was. But as soon as it made contact, the seemingly liquid metal surged toward me. It struck my legs, but my personal shield kept it from making contact with my clothing or skin. Exhaling with a sharp hiss, I changed the shape of my probe, using it to envelop the metallic thing. "Got you," I exclaimed. Lifting it into the air, I was amazed to see it become visible within my globe of force, a thick, viscous glob of what appeared to be liquid metal. There wasn't much of it. In total, it comprised perhaps a cup of liquid. Within my magical sphere, it shifted and moved, searching for an escape. "What is that?" asked Graham, his eyes growing wide. "Nothing good," I answered. I stood in the yard outside of the smithy that Matthew used for his workshop. "Is that enough?" I asked. A large pile of copper in irregular chunks and pieces lay on the ground in front of me, the product of another exercise of my connection to the earth. Gary glanced at Matthew, and after a moment, they both nodded. "It should be plenty," said the android. "I still don't understand why it takes this much material," I confessed. "It wouldn't," began the machine, "but we don't know what frequencies the enemy may be using, so I have to construct antennae of various sizes and orientations to make certain we detect whatever Ansys uses." "Orientation," I muttered. "Is that why they use a cross shape?" Matthew jumped in. "Exactly. If the transmitter is using a vertical antenna, then a horizontal one would miss the signal, and the opposite is also true." "What if they use a diagonal antenna?" I mused. "We would get a half-strength signal," said Gary confidently. "And why do you need different sizes?" I asked. "Wouldn't the largest antenna pick up everything the smaller ones would?" Matthew started to speak, but then deferred to Gary. Gary explained, "It depends on the wavelength of the signal. If the antenna is a quarter, a half, or the full length of the wavelength, you get a good signal. But if it's much larger or smaller, you won't. We have to match the resonant frequency length of a wide variety of possible signals." He went on for a while, and I found myself following much of it, but it was too much too soon. The topic was fascinating, but I already had too many other things to think about. I decided I would have to trust his expertise. Even so, I listened, storing his words away for further study. When he finally ran down and stopped, I was ready with my next question. "So, back at the functional end of this, you're going to use these small ring gates to put the output leads from each of these antennae in a central location here, and then connect yourself to all of them." Both of them nodded. Then Matthew added, "We'll also make sure that each lead has exactly the same distance from the antenna to its connection with Gary." "Why?" I asked. "To make sure he receives each signal at approximately the same time," said Matt. Gary held up his hand. "Well, I won't get them at the same time, but I intend to measure the difference in reception time for each antenna, and I don't want a disparity in the antenna lead length to confuse that." I felt stupid then. I should have remembered from our earlier discussion about trilateration. "Got it," I said. "By the way, I found something today. Take a look." Reaching into my pouch, I drew out the glass container holding the silver metal I'd found in Rose's rooms. The glass had been open on one end, but I'd used my power to heat and seal the open end, and then, for good measure, I'd enchanted the glass to make it nearly unbreakable. I wasn't taking any chances. Matthew frowned, and Gary simply stared. Neither said anything. "Any idea what it is?" I asked. "I found it hiding in the wreckage of Lady Rose's living room." Finally, Gary answered. "I think it's Ansys. A piece, anyway." Matthew muttered, "Great goo." "They finally made it work," added the android. Their responses were cryptic and frustrating. "Anyone care to explain? I get tired of mysterious answers." "It means we have already lost," declared the android. I fought the urge to choke him. I doubted it would do any good anyway, since he didn't breathe. Instead, I waited. My patience had improved with age. After a minute, he began to explain. "They've created programmable matter. That glass container holds a vast number of impossibly small machines, each communicating and coordinating. Together they can create almost anything you can imagine. Larger machines, for example. Assuming that is indeed them, and not just a container of quicksilver." I held up the glass. "So, with this amount they could construct a teacup or something similar in size. How does that equate to us having already lost?"
"Self-replication," said Matthew. "If it works the way it was described to me back on Karen's world, it can create more of itself. It could potentially convert the entire world into more of itself."
Gary nodded. My creator, the original Gary Miller, worked on the software for Ansys, but there were several other related departments trying to create something very like this. As far as I know, they made some progress, but never fully succeeded. Then where did this come from? I asked. Ansys is much smarter than those who created it, said Gary. It may have succeeded where they failed. However, I misspoke earlier. We should not give up hope yet. We don't know the properties of this new nanomaterial. It may not be able to self-replicate, as Matthew mentioned. It might still require larger facilities to produce it. Matthew spoke up. Why didn't you detect it? You were following its signals when Rose was attacked. How did it escape your notice afterward? Gary tapped his temple. No signal. It isn't attempting to communicate. When the attack failed, it probably ceased signaling to avoid detection. Let me try something. He held out his hand for the container. Somewhat begrudgingly, I handed it to him. The android held it in his hand without speaking, while he merely stared at it. A minute went by, and nothing happened. What are you doing? Trying to talk to it, said Gary. Let me focus. I'm trying a variety of different short-range radio signals. Nothing happened, but after a minute, the android spoke again. There it is. What did it say? I asked. He gave me one of his unsettling smiles. His mechanical body was an almost perfect human imitation, but it showed its artificial nature in certain expressions and gestures, and smiling was one of them. If questioned, I couldn't have put my finger on exactly what it was, but something about the expression didn't ring true, and it never failed to leave me feeling uncomfortable. I have no idea, said Gary. Ansys uses a variety of encryption methods, methods for which I do not have the key, otherwise I could attempt to alter its programming, or at the very minimum spy on its communications. This sample is communicating in the 2.4 gigahertz band. We'd already been through several discussions about the meaning of radio bands and wavelength, so I understood the gist of his statement, but I wasn't sure what it might imply. Does this help us? Yes and no, said Gary. It means I have a good reference for detecting their local communications, the signals they use to communicate within a few hundred feet. Unfortunately, I don't think there's any way we can easily build devices that can do that for us, not with the technology and materials you have available. Matthew chimed in. So, the only way we can detect them at close range is if you yourself are within the vicinity? The android nodded affirmatively. I ground my teeth. Great. Before I could verbalize my frustration, I heard the distinctive sound of the alarm I created years before, during what scholars had retroactively labeled the Godstone War. Chapter 23. The bell tower was ringing. Rushing out into the courtyard, I looked up at the nearest tower. A vivid blue light shone there, emanating from the enchanted crystal mounted atop it. A similar light was shining from all the wall towers, as well as the smaller towers protecting Washbrook. Everyone in the yard, stable grooms, men-at-arms, washerwomen, craftsmen, they all stood still, staring at the towers. It was as though the world was holding its breath. After a second, someone yelled, and they all began to run at once, heading in various directions. In the sky above, I could see the shield was up, visible only to my mage sight, a faintly glowing dome that covered the entirety of Castle Cameron and Washbrook. The people around me were heading for their assigned positions, which for most of them in the courtyard meant the keep itself. The castle denizens were supposed to muster in the Great Hall. In Washbrook, a similar process should be taking place, though it was likely a bit more chaotic. Most of the townsfolk would be heading for the tavern, the Muddy Pig, to take sanctuary in the hidden shelter built beneath it. There was an anxious feeling in the air, but it stopped short of panic. Since the time of my battle with the Shining Gods, we hadn't need to use the defenses, but I'd insisted in keeping up the practice of having a yearly drill, usually right before our midwinter festival. Thanks to that, the people knew how to respond. What I couldn't fathom, though, was why the alarm had been sounded. Was it Ansys? Had Tyrion decided to make war on us with the Shi'ar? Neither seemed likely, at least not yet. Matthew started to run past me, but I stopped him with a yell. Where are you going? The control room, he answered immediately. I shook my head. No, that's my job. You take position at the main gate. What about me, Your Excellency? Asked Gary. You head to the great... No, scratch that. You stay with my son. If this is Ansys, you might have some insight to offer him, I ordered. Without waiting to hear their responses, I lifted myself into the air and shot towards the doors to the main keep. They'd already been thrown wide to accept the influx of castle servants, and rather than mingle with them, I flew over their heads. It was a short trip down the hall and around a corner before I reached the hidden door to the secret chamber that controlled the castle's defenses. Pressing my hand against a certain spot on the wall, I stepped through the door that opened in front of me. Elaine was already inside, which meant she was the one who'd activated the castle's shield. "What's happening?" I asked.
"We're under attack,"
she replied immediately.
"Who?"
Elaine waved her hand at the wall.
"You tell me. I don't recognize them."
The wall she indicated was covered in large panes of enchanted glass. The enchantment on the glass was just to protect it, making it incredibly strong and hard to break. The glass covered small portals that opened on the exterior walls of the towers around Castle Cameron and Washbrook. Without the glass, an enemy could fire projectiles directly into the control chamber through the viewing portals when they were active. Most of the portals showed nothing unusual, but those on the towers flanking the gate of Washbrook showed what appeared at first glance to be a small army. On second glance, I decided it was definitely an army, but it didn't look like any army I'd seen before. Heavy-set men in some sort of strange plate stood in vague lines in front of the gate. Their heads and chests were covered in some sort of metal plate, but their legs and arms were less protected, covered only in some kind of heavy leather. Or was that their skin? I revised my initial impression. They weren't men, or at least none I'd ever seen before. They were short, perhaps only 4.5 feet in height, and close to being as wide as they were tall. Judging by their thick arms and legs, they were probably very strong. Most of them carried steel-rimmed square shields. Those in the front ranks had one-handed axes, while those behind had some sort of pole arm similar to a halberd. No, more like a bardiche, I corrected myself. The weapons were mounted on long hafts, 8 or 9 feet in length, with a long blade with a wicked tip at the end, making them suitable for both chopping and thrusting. The rear ranks carried crossbows, though they were far heavier than any I'd seen troops carry before. They looked dangerously brutal. Having faced an army at the gates before, and being familiar with the distances between the wall towers, I was able to do a rough calculation of the enemy's numbers. 700, maybe 800 men, or whatever they are, I thought. Certainly they far outnumbered the men guarding Cameron and Washbrook. People often make the mistake of thinking that lords kept small private armies within their castle walls, while nothing could be further from the truth. Castles usually had only the staff required to keep them running and a relatively small force of guards. Men-at-arms were expensive to feed and maintain. The real point of a fortified castle was that it didn't take that many men to defend. 10 or 20 men with strong walls could hold off a force of hundreds for long periods of time. In fact, I had nearly 60 guards within the walls of Castle Cameron, but only because we'd made our recent expedition. Otherwise, half of those would have been elsewhere, tending to their homes and families. In times of war, I could muster perhaps 200 levies, peasant soldiers, but that took at least a week's advance notice. With over 50 men, we could defend the castle from a force this size, even without a magical shield and wizards, but it was unlikely we could keep them out of Washbrook. Fortunately, that wasn't a concern. The magical shield protecting the village as well as the castle was designed to withstand even the forces and powers of a god. But I didn't intend to wait within our perfect defenses. The enemy at our gates would soon realize they couldn't breach the shield. What would they do then? Historically, the answer was that they would burn and pillage everything that they could reach. The mill, herders, and tenant farmers all would pay the price for our neglect. Most of them were still in the surrounding countryside, and even those that had retreated into Washbrook would lose their homes, crops, and property. No human army, local or otherwise, would have dared present themselves before my gates. The last army to do so, a force of nearly 30,000 from Gododdin, had been burned, crushed, and then drowned. In my overzealous desire to make certain that no one forgot the lesson, I had killed them all to nearly the last man. The only reason I wasn't called the Butcher of Battle Cameron was because I'd committed more memorable atrocities in the years that followed.
"What will you do?"
asked Elaine, interrupting my thoughts. I shrugged. "What else? Parley. If that doesn't work, I'll get rid of them." Before I stepped out the door, I added, "Watch for my signal at the Washbrook gate. When you see it, let me through, then close it behind me."
"But..."
she started to protest, but I ignored her, closing the door after me. A variety of people yelled for my attention as I headed toward the keep entrance. Sir Graham and Captain Draper were the first I addressed. "Graham, you're coming with me. Captain Draper, assemble all but the sentries near the Washbrook gate. I'll be going out to parley." Penny was next. She stood by the door, already in her armor, the empty sleeve of her mail hauberk pulled tight and tied in front of her.
"You aren't going out there,"
she said firmly.
"Someone else can talk to them."
I met her brown eyes, staring into the dark depths of her resolve. How many times had we faced similar situations together? Every case had been different. Sometimes she'd been my guardian, and other times she'd been forced to take other roles. If I didn't take her with me, there would be hell to pay later. In my youth, I'd often agonized over my decisions. I was not that man anymore. Organize those sheltering in the keep. Reassure them, I told her. I don't think there's any real danger to them, but a panic would be dangerous. If something does go wrong, I trust you to do whatever is necessary. She started to argue, but I held up one hand, cutting her off. Penny's face blanched at my brusqueness. I'll definitely pay for that, I sighed inwardly. Matthew, Moira, you'll come with me to the gate in Washbrook. Connell, Irene, you'll take positions at the castle gatehouse. Captain Draper, make sure they have at least 2 guardsmen with each of them. They'll be responsible for managing any threat that gets through Washbrook, I commanded. With those words, I began walking again. Graham and my 2 children fell in behind me.
Thank you, said Moira.
I assumed she meant because I brought the 2 of them along. Don't, I told her. You'll both be staying inside the walls, acting as reserves in case I do something stupid and get myself killed or incapacitated. Only Graham and Myra will accompany me outside.
What about the dragons? Prompted Matthew.
I glanced up and over my shoulder toward the eyrie that lay in the mountains behind us. The dragons were currently up there, outside the protection of the shield over Cameron. They're safe where they are, I noted. I don't intend to drop the shield to bring them in.
They could strafe the enemy with dragonfire, suggested Graham.
Our guests have rather formidable-looking crossbows, I informed him, since he hadn't seen the enemy yet. The damn things are like small ballistae. I'm sure the dragons could inflict serious harm, perhaps even rout them, but I'd rather not risk them being injured. 5 minutes later, we stood in front of the town gate. Several nervous-looking town militiamen stood close by. The first to approach me was Simon McAllister. Technically, he was in charge of Washbrook's small citizen guard, but he was a cobbler by trade.
My lord,
he addressed me, bobbing his head respectfully.
Washbrook stands ready.
His serious tone almost made me chuckle. The Washbrook militia was made up of older men, those too old to serve as soldiers if I had to call up my levies. Many of them had some past military experience, but all of them were long past their prime. They were intended as auxiliaries in the event that my actual soldiers were absent or if they'd been overwhelmed. I knew better than to dismiss him, though. However old he might be, Simon meant business. Have your men hold their positions in the towers, I ordered. Keep your bows ready. Let Captain Draper's men handle the walls and gate if it comes to a melee. Stepping up to the gate, I raised my voice.
Open it, and be sure to close it tightly after we're through.
They did, and seconds later, the massive oaken timbers of the gate began to move, swinging inward. Moira had already released her alter ego, Myra, and she and Graham followed me closely, one on either side. Matthew and Moira followed a short distance behind. When we'd reached the shield, which stood some 5 feet from the walls, I turned back to them.
When I signal Elaine to open the shield gate, stay here. Do not have her open it again until we return. If things go wrong, don't open it unless we're close and you think you can get us back safely. Remember, there are hundreds of people in Washbrook. Their lives are more important than ours.
Neither of the twins looked happy. Matthew's expression was one of disappointment, while Moira's face spoke clearly of her opinions. She thinks I'm an idiot, I noted. At least she had the sense to hold her tongue.
I think you're an idiot, she said aloud, echoing my thoughts. Captain Draper should be the one to do this, added Matthew, agreeing with his sister for a change.
Already full of tension, I found myself unable to muster any anger at their verbal mutiny. Your objections are noted. Now do as I say. Then I held up my hand and made a vertical slash in the air. Elaine was watching through the window portals, and that was my signal to open the shield. A second later, I felt an opening appear in the air in front of me, 20 feet wide and 20 feet high. I stepped forward, leading Graham and Myra. The first thing I noticed was the wind on my cheeks. It had been conspicuously absent before, since the protective dome had enforced a calm over Washbrook. There weren't many clouds, and the sun warmed the side of my face that wasn't being buffeted by the breeze. It felt good. It was always like this during these moments. Anxiety and adrenaline drive the mind and body into a state of hyper-awareness, and often the things one notices most are the small impressions that are frequently ignored during everyday life. In the air I could smell the trees from across the field, as well as a hint of sheep dung. The enemy was less than 100 yards away, watching us carefully. I began walking toward them as the shield closed once more behind us. Graham was silent as he walked by my side, a moving statue of shining metal. Speaking to Myra, I asked, Can you get anything from here? Being a spell twin of Moira, she possessed the same gift of the Sentir that my daughter did.
Their minds are strange, she responded. They don't speak our language, and there's an odd resistance, as though they're shielding their minds. I can feel their wariness, but little else. They think this might